But the sight of all that gold and onyx still filled her with resentment. The more we give these Tyrells, the more they demand of us. When all the vows were spoken, the king and his new queen stepped outside the sept to accept congratulations. Westeros has two queens now, and the young one is as beautiful as the old one, boomed Lyle Crakehall, an oaf of a knight who oft reminded Cersei of her late and unlamented husband. She could have slapped him. Giles Rosby made to kiss her hand and only succeeded in coughing on her fingers. Lord Redwine kissed her on one cheek and Mace Tyrell on both. Grand Maester Pycelle told Cersei that she had not lost a son, but rather gained a daughter. At least she was spared Lady Tanda's tearful embraces. None of the Stokeworth women had appeared, and for that much the Queen was grateful. Amongst the last was Kevin Lannister. "I understand you mean to leave us for another wedding," the Queen said to him. "Hardstone has cleared the broken men from Darry Castle," he replied. "Lancel's bride awaits us there. Will your lady wife be joining you for the nuptials?" "The Riverlands are still too dangerous. Vargo Hote's scum remain abroad, and Beric Dondarrion has been hanging Freys. Is it true that Sandor Clegane has joined him?" "How does he know that?" "Some say. Reports are confused. The bird had come last night from a septary on an island hard by the mouth of the Trident. The nearby town of Saltpans had been savagely raided by a band of outlaws, and some of the survivors claimed a roaring brute in a hound's head helm was among the raiders. Supposedly he'd killed a dozen men and raped a girl of 12. No doubt Lancel will be eager to hunt down Clegane and Lord Beric both, to restore the king's peace to the Riverlands." Sir Kevin stared into her eyes for a moment. "My son is not the man to deal with Sandor Clegane. We agree on that much, at least. His father might be." Her uncle's mouth grew hard. "If my service is not required at the Rock, your service was required here." Cersei had named her cousin Damian Lannister, a castellan for the Rock, and another cousin, Sir Davin Lannister, the Warden of the West. "Insolence has its price, uncle. Bring us Sandor's head, and I know his grace will be most grateful. Joff may have liked the man, but Tommen was always afraid of him, with good reason, it would seem. When a dog goes bad, the fault lies with his master," Sir Kevin said. Then he turned and walked away. Jaime escorted her to the small hall, where the feast was being readied. "I blame you for all this," she whispered as they walked. "Let them wed," you said. "Margaery should be mourning Joffrey not marrying his brother. She should be as sick with grief as I am. I do not believe she is a maid. Renly had a cock, didn't he? He was Robert's brother. He surely had a cock. If that disgusting old crone thinks that I will allow my son to—" "You will be rid of Lady Olenna soon enough," Jaime broke in quietly. "She's returning to Highgarden on the morrow." "So she says." Cersei did not trust any Tyrell promise. "She's leaving," he insisted. "Mace is taking half the Tyrell strength to Storm's End, and the other half will be going back to the Reach with Sir Garlan to make good his claim on Brightwater. A few more days, and the only roses left in King's Landing will be Margaery and her ladies and a few guardsmen. And Sir Loras, or have you forgotten your sworn brother? Sir Loras is a knight of a king's guard. Sir Loras is so Tyrell he pisses rose water. He should never have been given a white cloak. He would not have been my choice, I'll grant you. No one troubled to consult me. Loras will do well enough, I think. Once a man puts on that cloak, it changes him." "It certainly changed you, and not for the better." "I love you too, sweet sister." He held the door for her and walked her to the high table and her seat beside the king. Margaery was on the other side of Tommen in the place of honor. When she entered arm in arm with the little king, she made a point of stopping to kiss Cersei on the cheeks and throw her arms around her. "Your grace," the girl said, bold as polished brass, "I feel as though I have a second mother now. I pray that we shall be very close, united by our love for your sweet son. I loved both my sons. Geoffrey is in my prayers as well, said Marjorie. I loved him dearly, though I never had the chance to know him. Liar, the Queen thought, if you had loved him even for an instant, you would not have been in such unseemly haste to wed his brother. His crown was all you ever wanted. For half a groat she would have slapped the blushing bride right there upon the dais, in view of half the court. Like the service, the wedding feast was modest. Lady Allery had made all the arrangements. Circe had not had the stomach to face that daunting task again, after the way Joffrey's wedding had ended. Only 7 courses were served. Butterbumps and Moonboy entertained the guests between dishes, and musicians played as they ate. They listened to pipers and fiddlers, a lute and a flute, a high harp. The only singer was some favorite of Lady Marjorie's, a dashing young cock-a-whoop, clad all in shades of azure, who called himself the Blue Bard. He sang a few love songs and retired. What a disappointment! Lady Olenna complained loudly. I was hoping for the reigns of Castamere. Whenever Circe looked at the old crone, the face of Maggie the Frog seemed to float before her eyes, wrinkled and terrible and wise. All old women look alike, she tried to tell herself. That's all it is. In truth, the bent-back sorceress had looked nothing like the Queen of Thorns. Yet somehow the sight of Lady Olenna's nasty little smile was enough to put her back in Maggie's tent again. She could still remember the smell of it, redolent with queer eastern spices and the softness of Maggie's gums as she sucked the blood from Circe's finger. Queen you shall be, the old woman had promised, with her lips still wet and red and glistening, until there comes another younger and more beautiful to cast you down and take all that you hold dear. Circe glanced past Tommen to where Marjorie sat laughing with her father. She is pretty enough, she had to admit, but most of that is youth. Even peasant girls are pretty at a certain age, when they are still fresh and innocent and unspoiled, and most of them have the same brown hair and brown eyes as she does. Only a fool would ever claim she was more beautiful than I. The world was full of fools, however. So was her son's court. Her mood was not improved when Mace Tyrell arose to lead the toasts. He raised a golden goblet high, smiling at his pretty little daughter, and in a booming voice said, "To the king and queen!" The other sheep all baaed along with him. "The king and queen!" they cried, smashing their cups together. "The king and queen!" She had no choice but to drink along with them, all the time wishing that the guests had but a single face, so she could throw her wine into their eyes and remind them that she was the true queen. The only one of Tyrell's lickspittles who seemed to remember her at all was Paxter Redwine, who rose to make his own toast, swaying slightly. "To both our queens," he chirruped, "to the young queen and the old." Circe drank several cups of wine and pushed her food around a golden plate. Jamie ate even less and seldom deigned to occupy his seat upon the dais. "He is as anxious as I am," the queen realized as she watched him prowl the hall, twitching aside the tapestries with his good hand to assure himself that no one was hiding behind them. There were Lannister spearmen posted around the building, she knew. Sir Osmond Kettleblack guarded one door, Sir Merin Trant the other. Balon Swan stood behind the king's chair, Loras Tyrell behind the queen's. No swords had been allowed inside the feast, save for those the white knights bore. "My son is safe," Circe told herself. "No harm can come to him, not here, not now." Yet every time she looked at Tommen, she saw Joffrey clawing at his throat. And when the boy began to cough, the queen's heart stopped beating for a moment. She knocked aside a serving girl in her haste to reach him.
"Only a little wine that went down the wrong way,"
Marjorie Tyrell assured her, smiling. She took Tommen's hand in her own and kissed his fingers.
"My little love needs to take smaller sips. See, you scared your lady mother half to death." "I'm sorry, mother,"
Tommen said, abashed. It was more than Circe could stand. "I cannot let them see me cry," she thought, when she felt the tears welling in her eyes. She walked past Sir Merin Trant and out into the back passage. Alone beneath a tallow candle, she allowed herself a shuddering sob, then another. A woman may weep, but not a queen. "Your Grace," said a voice behind her, "do I intrude?" It was a woman's voice, flavored with the accents of the East. For an instant, she feared that Maggie the Frog was speaking to her from the grave. But it was only Merryweather's wife, the slow-eyed beauty Lord Orton had wed during his exile, and fetched home with him to Long Table. "The small hall is so stuffy," Circe heard herself say. "The smoke was making my eyes water." "And mine, Your Grace." Lady Merryweather was as tall as the Queen, but dark instead of fair, raven-haired and olive-skinned, and younger by a decade. She offered the Queen a pale blue handkerchief of silk and lace. "I have a son as well. I know that I shall weep rivers on the day he weds." Circe wiped her cheeks, furious that she had let her tears be seen. "My thanks," she said stiffly. "Your Grace, I..." The Mirish woman lowered her voice. "There is something you must know. Your maid is bought and paid for. She tells Lady Marjorie everything you do." "Sanel?" Sudden fury twisted in the Queen's belly. Was there no one she could trust? "You are certain of this?" "Have her followed. Marjorie never meets with her directly. Her cousins are her ravens. They bring her messages. Sometimes Eleanor, sometimes Alla, sometimes Mega. All of them are as close to Marjorie as sisters. They meet in the sept and pretend to pray. Put your own man in the gallery on the morrow, and he will see Sanel whispering to Mega beneath the altar of the maiden. If this is true, why tell me you are one of Marjorie's companions? Why would you betray her?" Circe had learned suspicion at her father's knee. This could well be some trap, a lie meant to sow discord between the lion and the rose. "Long Table may be sworn to High Garden," the woman replied with a toss of her black hair, "but I am of Mere, and my loyalty is to my husband and my son. I want all that is best for them." "I see." In the closeness of the passage, the Queen could smell the other woman's perfume, a musky scent that spoke of moss and earth and wildflowers. Under it, she smelled ambition. "She gave testimony at Tyrion's trial," Circe recalled suddenly. "She saw the imp put the poison in Joff's cup and was not afraid to say so." "I shall look into this," she promised. "If what you say is true, you will be rewarded. And if you've lied to me, I'll have your tongue and your lord husband's lands and gold as well. Your Grace is kind and beautiful." Lady Merryweather smiled. Her teeth were white, her lips full and dark. When the Queen returned to the small hall, she found her brother pacing restlessly. "It was only a gulp of wine that went down the wrong way, though it startled me as well. My belly is such a knot that I cannot eat," she growled at him. "The wine tastes of bile. This wedding was a mistake." "This wedding was necessary. The boy is safe." "Fool! No one who wears a crown is ever safe." She looked about the hall. Mace Tyrell laughed amongst his knights. Lords Redwine and Rowan were talking furtively. Sir Kevin sat brooding over his wine at the back of the hall, whilst Lancel whispered something to a septon. Sanel was moving down the table, filling the cups of the bride's cousins with wine as red as blood. Grand Maester Pycelle had fallen asleep. "There is no one I can rely upon, not even Jamie," she realized grimly. "I will need to sweep them all away and surround the king with mine own people." Later, after sweets and nuts and cheese had been served and cleared away, Marjorie and Tommen began the dancing, looking more than a bit ridiculous as they whirled about the floor. The Tyrell girl stood a good foot and a half taller than her little husband, and Tommen was a clumsy dancer at best, with none of Joffrey's easy grace. He did his earnest best, though, and seemed oblivious to the spectacle he was making of himself. And no sooner was Maid Marjorie done with him than her cousins swooped in, one after the other, insisting that his grace must dance with them as well. They will have him stumbling and shuffling like a fool by the time they're done, Circe thought resentfully as she watched. Half the court will be laughing at him behind his back. Whilst Alla, Eleanor, and Megha took their turns with Tommen, Marjorie took a turn around the floor with her father, then another with her brother Loras. The Knight of Flowers was in white silk, with a belt of golden roses about his waist and a jade rose fastening his cloak. They could be twins, Circe thought as she watched them. Sir Loras was a year older than his sister, but they had the same big brown eyes, the same thick brown hair falling in lazy ringlets to their shoulders, the same smooth, unblemished skin. A ripe crop of pimples would teach them some humility. Loras was taller and had a few wisps of soft brown fuzz on his face, and Marjorie had a woman's shape, but elsewise they were more alike than she and Jamie. That annoyed her too. Her own twin interrupted her musings. Would your grace honour her white knight with a dance? She gave him a withering look. And have you fumbling at me with that stump? No. I will let you fill my wine cup for me, though, if you think you can manage it without spilling. A cripple like me? Not likely. He moved away and made another circuit of the hall. She had to fill her own cup. Circe refused Mace Tyrell as well, and later Lancel. The others took the hint, and no one else approached her. Our fast friends and loyal lords. She could not even trust the Westermen, her father's sworn swords and bannermen, not if her own uncle was conspiring with her enemies. Marjorie was dancing with her cousin Alla, Megha with Sir Tallard the Tall. The other cousin, Eleanor, was sharing a cup of wine with the handsome young bastard of Driftmark, Aurain Waters. It was not the first time the Queen had made note of Waters, a lean young man with grey-green eyes and long silver-gold hair. The first time she had seen him, for half a heartbeat, she had almost thought Rhaegar Targaryen had returned from the ashes. "It is his hair," she told herself. "He is not half as comely as Rhaegar was. His face is too narrow, and he has that cleft in his chin." The Valerians came from old Valyrian stock, however, and some had the same silvery hair as the dragon kings of old. Tommen returned to his seat to nibble at an apple cake. Her uncle's place was empty. The queen finally found him in a corner, talking intently with Mace Tyrell's son, Garlan. What do they have to talk about? The Reach might call Sir Garlan gallant, but she trusted him no more than Marjorie or Loras. She had not forgotten the gold coin that Caiban had discovered beneath the jailer's chamber pot. A golden hand from Highgarden, and Marjorie is spying on me. When Sinel appeared to fill her wine cup, the queen had to resist an urge to take her by the throat and throttle her. "Do not presume to smile at me, you treacherous little bitch. You will be begging me for mercy before I'm done with you." "I think Her Grace has had enough wine for one night," she heard her brother Jamie say. "No," the queen thought, "or the wine in the world would not be enough to see me through this wedding." She rose so fast she almost fell. Jamie caught her by the arm and steadied her. She wrenched free and clapped her hands together. The music died, the voices stilled. "Lords and ladies," Circe called out loudly, "if you will be so good as to come outside with me, we shall light a candle to celebrate the union of Highgarden and Casterly Rock, and a new age of peace and plenty for our seven kingdoms." Dark and forlorn stood the Tower of the Hand, with only gaping holes where oaken doors and shuttered windows had once been. Yet even ruined and slighted, it loomed above the outer ward. As the wedding guests filed out of the small hall, they passed beneath its shadow. When Circe looked up, she saw towers, crenellated battlements, gnawing at a hunter's moon, and wondered for a moment how many hands of how many kings had made their home there over the past 3 centuries. 100 yards from the tower, she took a breath to stop her head from spinning. "Lord Halline, you may commence," Halline the pyromancer said. And waved the torch he was holding, and the archers on the walls bent to their bows and sent a dozen flaming arrows through the gaping windows. The tower went up with a whoosh. In half a heartbeat, its interior was alive with light, red, yellow, orange, and green, an ominous dark green, the color of bile and jade and pyromancer's piss. The substance, the alchemists named it, but common folk called it wildfire. 50 pots had been placed inside the Tower of the Hand, along with logs and casks of pitch, and the greater part of the worldly possessions of a dwarf named Tyrion Lannister. The queen could feel the heat of those green flames. The pyromancers said that only 3 things burned hotter than their substance: dragonflame, the fires beneath the earth, and the summer sun. Some of the ladies gasped when the first flames appeared in the windows, licking up the outer walls like long green tongues. Others cheered and made toasts. "It is beautiful," she thought, "as beautiful as Joffrey when they laid him in my arms." No man had ever made her feel as good as she had felt when he took her nipple in his mouth to nurse. Tommen stared wide-eyed at the fires, as fascinated as he was frightened, until Marjorie whispered something in his ear that made him laugh. Some of the knights began to make wagers on how long it would be before the tower collapsed. Lord Halline stood humming to himself and rocking on his heels. Circe thought of all the king's hands that she had known through the years. Owen Merriweather, John Connington, Carlton Chelsted, John Arryn, Eddard Stark, her brother Tyrion, and her father, Lord Tywin Lannister, her father most of all. "All of them are burning now," she told herself, savoring the thought. "They are dead and burning, every one, with all their plots and schemes and betrayals. It is my day now. It is my castle and my kingdom." The Tower of the Hand gave out a sudden groan, so loud that all the conversation stopped abruptly. Stone cracked and split, and part of the upper battlements fell away and landed with a crash that shook the hill, sending up a cloud of dust and smoke. As fresh air rushed in through the broken masonry, the fire surged upward. Green flames leapt into the sky and whirled around each other. Tommen shied away till Marjorie took his hand and said, "Look, the flames are dancing, just as we did, my love." "They are." His voice was filled with wonder. "Mother, look, they're dancing."
"I see them. Lord Halline, how long will the fires burn?"
"All night, Your Grace."
"It makes a pretty candle, I grant you," said Lady Olenna Tyrell, leaning on her cane between left and right. "Bright enough to see us safe to sleep, I think. Old bones grow weary, and these young ones have had enough excitement for one night. It is time the king and queen were put to bed."
"Yes,"
Circe beckoned to Jaime. "Lord Commander, escort His Grace and his little queen to their pillows, if you would."
"As you command."
"And you as well?"
"No need."
Circe felt too alive for sleep. The wildfire was cleansing her, burning away all her rage and fear, filling her with resolve.
"The flames are so pretty. I want to watch them for a while."
Jaime hesitated.
"You should not stay alone."
"I will not be alone. Sir Osmond can remain with me and keep me safe. Your sworn brother."
"If it please Your Grace," said Kettle Black.
"It does."
Circe slid her arm through his, and side by side they watched the fire rage.
Daenerys. The Dothraki name the comet Shirakia, the Bleeding Star. The old men muttered that it omened ill, but Daenerys Targaryen had seen it first on the night she had burned Khal Drogo, the night her dragons had awakened. "It is the herald of my coming," she told herself as she gazed up into the night sky with wonder in her heart. "The gods have sent it to show me the way." Yet when she put the thought into words, her handmaid Doria quailed,
"That way lies the Redlands, Khaleesi, a grim place, and terrible, the riders say."
"The way the comet points is the way we must go," Dany insisted, though in truth it was the only way open to her. She dare not turn north into the vast ocean of grass they call the Dothraki Sea. The first Khalasar they met would swallow up her ragged band, slaying the warriors and slaving the rest. The lands of the Lamb Men south of the river were likewise closed to them. They were too few to defend themselves, even against that unwarlike folk, and the Lazarene had small reason to love them. She might have struck downriver for the ports of Marine and Yunkai and Astapor, but Ricardo warned her that Pono's Khalasar had ridden that way, driving thousands of captives before them to sail in the flesh marts that festered like open sores on the shores of Slaver's Bay. "Why should I fear Pono?" Danny objected. "He was Drogo's co, and always spoke me gently." "Co Pono spoke you gently," Sir Jorah Mormont said. "Carl Pono will kill you. He was the first to abandon Drogo. 10,000 warriors went with him. You have 100." "No," Danny thought, "I have 4. The rest are women, old sick men, and boys whose hair has never been braided." "I have the dragons," she pointed out. "Hatchlings," Sir Jorah said. "One swipe from an Arrak would put an end to them. Though Pono is more like to seize them for himself. Your dragon eggs were more precious than rubies. A living dragon is beyond price. In all the world there are only 3. Every man who sees them will want them, my queen." "They are mine," she said fiercely. They had been born from her faith and her need, given life by the deaths of her husband and unborn son and the Magi Mira Mas Duur. Danny had walked into the flames as they came forth, and they had drunk milk from her swollen breasts. "No man will take them from me while I live."
"You will not live long should you meet Carl Pono, nor Carl Jacko, nor any of the others. You must go where they do not."
Danny had named him the first for Queen's Guard, and when Mormont's gruff counsel and the omens agreed, her course was clear. She called her people together and mounted her silver mare. Her hair had burned away in Drogo's pyre, so her handmaids garbed her in the skin of the Hakkar Drogo had slain, the white lion of the Dothraki Sea. Its fearsome head made a hood to cover her naked scalp, its pelt a cloak that flowed across her shoulders and down her back. The cream-coloured dragon sunk sharp black claws into the lion's mane and coiled its tail around her arm while Sir Jorah took his accustomed place by her side. "We follow the comet," Danny told her Khalasar. Once it was said, no word was raised against it. They had been Drogo's people, but they were hers now. The Unburnt, they called her, and Mother of Dragons. Her word was their law. They rode by night, and by day they took refuge from the sun beneath the tents. Soon enough, Danny learnt the truth of Doria's words. This was no kindly country. They left a trail of dead and dying horses behind them as they went. For Pono, Jaco, and the others had seized the best of Drogo's herds, leaving to Danny the old and the scrawny, the sickly and the lame, the broken animals and the ill-tempered. It was the same with the people. "They are not strong," she told herself, "so I must be their strength. I must show no fear, no weakness, no doubt. However frightened my heart, when they look upon my face, they must see only Drogo's queen." She felt older than her 14 years. If ever she had truly been a girl, that time was done. 3 days into the march, the first man died. A toothless oldster with cloudy blue eyes, he fell exhausted from his saddle and could not rise again. An hour later, he was done. Blood flies swarmed about his corpse and carried his ill luck to the living.
"His time was past," her handmaid Iri declared. "No man should live longer than his teeth."
The others agreed. Danny bid them kill the weakest of their dying horses, so the dead man might go mounted into the Nightlands. 2 nights later, it was an infant girl who perished. Her mother's anguish wailing lasted all day, but there was nothing to be done. The child had been too young to ride, poor thing. Not for her the endless black grasses of the Nightlands. she must be born again. There was little forage in the red waste and less water. It was a sere and desolate land of low hills and barren windswept plains. The rivers they crossed were dry as dead men's bones. Their mounts subsisted on the tough brown devil grass that grew in clumps at the base of rocks and dead trees. Denny sent outriders ranging ahead of the column, but they found neither wells nor springs, only bitter pools, shallow and stagnant, shrinking in the hot sun. The deeper they rode into the waste, the smaller the pools became, while the distance between them grew. If there were gods in this trackless wilderness of stone and sand and red clay, they were hard, dry gods, deaf to prayers for rain. Wine gave out first, and soon thereafter the clotted mare's milk the horse lords loved better than mead. Then their stores of flatbread and dried meat were exhausted as well. Their hunters found no game, and only the flesh of their dead horses filled their bellies. Death followed death. Weak children, wrinkled old women, the sick and the stupid and the heedless, the cruel lands claimed them all. Doria grew gaunt and hollow-eyed, and her soft golden hair turned brittle as straw. Denny hungered and thirsted with the rest of them. The milk in her breasts dried up, her nipples cracked and bled, and the flesh fell away from her day by day until she was lean and hard as a stick. Yet it was her dragons she feared for. Her father had been slain before she was born, and her splendid brother Rhaegar as well. Her mother had died bringing her into the world, while the storm screamed outside. Gentle Sir Willem Darry, who must have loved her after a fashion, had been taken by a wasting sickness when she was very young. Her brother Viserys, Khal Drogo, who was her sun and stars, even her unborn son, the gods had claimed them all. "They will not have my dragons," Danny vowed. "They will not." The dragons were no larger than the scrawny cats she had once seen skulking along the walls of Magister Illyrio's estate in Pentos, until they unfolded their wings. Their span was three times their length, each wing a delicate fan of translucent skin, gorgeously coloured, stretched taut between long, thin bones. When you looked hard, you could see that most of their body was neck, tail, and wing. Such little things, she thought, as she fed them by hand. Or rather, tried to feed them, for the dragons would not eat. They would hiss and spit at each bloody morsel of horse meat, steam rising from their nostrils, yet they would not take the food. Until Danny recalled something Viserys had told her when they were children. "Only dragons and men eat cooked meat," he had said. When she had her handmaids char the horse meat black, the dragons ripped at it eagerly, their heads striking like snakes. So long as the meat was seared, they gulped down several times their own weight every day, and at last began to grow larger and stronger. Danny marvelled at the smoothness of their scales, and the heat that poured off them, so palpable that on cold nights their whole bodies seemed to steam. Each evenfall, as the Khalasar set out, she would choose a dragon to ride upon her shoulder. Iri and Jiqui carried the others in a cage of woven wood slung between their mounts and rode close behind her, so Danny was never out of their sight. It was the only way to keep them quiescent. Aegon's dragons were named for the gods of old Valyria, she told her blood riders one morning after a long night's journey. Visenya's dragon was Vhagar, Rhaenys had Meraxes, and Aegon rode Balerion, the Black Dread. It was said that Vhagar's breath was so hot that he could melt a knight's armour and cook the man inside, that Meraxes swallowed horses whole, and Balerion, his fire, was as black as his scales,
his wings so vast that whole towns were swallowed up in their shadow when he passed overhead. The Dothraki looked at her hatchlings uneasily. The largest of her three was shiny black, his scales slashed with streaks of vivid scarlet to match his wings and horns. "Khaleesi," Aegor murmured, "there sits Balerion come again." "It may be as you say, blood of my blood," Dany replied gravely, "but he shall have a new name for his new life. I would name them all for those the gods have taken. The green one shall be Rhaegal, for my valiant brother, who died on the green banks of the Trident. The cream and gold I shall call Viserion. Viserys was cruel and weak and frightened, yet he was my brother still. His dragon will do what he could not."
"And the black beast?" asked Ser Jorah Mormont.
"The black," she said, "is Drogon." Yet even as her dragons prospered, the Khalasar withered and died. Around them the land grew ever more desolate. Even devil grass grew scant. Horses dropped in their tracks, leaving so few that some of her people must trudge along on foot. Doria took a fever and grew worse with every league they crossed. Her lips and hands broke with blood blisters. Her hair came out in clumps, and one even fall, she lacked the strength to mount her horse. Jogo said they must leave her or bind her to her saddle. But Dany remembered a night on the Dothraki Sea when the Lycian girl had taught her secrets so that Drogo might love her more. She gave Doria water from her own skin, cooled her brow with a damp cloth, and held her hand until she died, shivering. Only then would she permit the Khalasar to press on. They saw no sign of other travellers. The Dothraki began to mutter fearfully that the comet had led them to some hell. Dany went to Ser Jorah one morning, as they made camp amidst a jumble of black wind-scoured stones. "Are we lost?" she asked him. "Does this waste have no end to it?"
"It has an end," he answered wearily. "I have seen the maps, the traders draw, my queen. Few caravans come this way, that is so. Yet there are great kingdoms to the east, and cities full of wonder. Yeti, Kars, Ashai by the shadow.
Will we live to see them?"
"I will not lie to you. The way is harder than I dared think."
The knight's face was grey and exhausted. The wound he had taken to his hip the night he fought Khal Drogo's blood riders had never fully healed. She could see how he grimaced when he mounted his horse, and he seemed to slump in his saddle as they rode.
"Perhaps we are doomed if we press on, but I know for a certainty that we are doomed if we turn back."
Dany kissed him lightly on the cheek. It heartened her to see him smile. "I must be strong for him as well," she thought grimly. "A knight he may be, but I am the blood of the dragon." The next pool they found was scalding hot and stinking of brimstone, but their skins were almost empty. The Dothraki cooled the water in jars and pots and drank it tepid. The taste was no less foul, but water was water, and all of them thirsted. Dany looked at the horizon with despair. They had lost a third of their number, and still the waste stretched before them bleak and red and endless. "The comet mocks my hopes," she thought, lifting her eyes to where it scored the sky. "Have I crossed half the world and seen the birth of dragons only to die with them in this hard, hot desert?" She would not believe it. The next day, dawn broke as they were crossing a cracked and fissured plain of hard red earth. Dany was about to command them to make camp when her outriders came racing back at a gallop. "A city, Khaleesi," they cried. "A city pale as a moon and lovely as a maid, an hour's ride, no more." "Show me," she said. When the city appeared before her,
its walls and towers shimmering white behind a veil of heat. It looked so beautiful that Danny was certain it must be a mirage. "Do you know what place this might be?" she asked Sir Jorah. The exile knight gave a weary shake of the head.
"No, my queen, I have never travelled this far east."
The distant white walls promised rest and safety, a chance to heal and grow strong, and Danny wanted nothing so much as to rush toward them. Instead, she turned to her blood riders. "Blood of my blood, go ahead of us and learn the name of this city and what manner of welcome we should expect."
"Aye, Khaleesi," said Aego.
Her riders were not long in returning. Rakaro swung down from his saddle. From his medallion belt hung a great curving arrack that Danny had bestowed on him when she named him Blood Rider.
"This city is dead, Khaleesi. Nameless and godless we found it. The gates broken. Only wind and flies moving through the streets."
Jiquis shuddered. "When the gods are gone, the evil ghosts feast by night. Such places are best shunned, it is known."
"It is known," Iri agreed.
"Not to me." Danny put her heels into her horse and showed them the way, trotting beneath the shattered arch of an ancient gate and down a silent street. Sir Jorah and her blood riders followed, and then, more slowly, the rest of the Dothraki. How long the city had been deserted, she could not know, but the white walls, so beautiful from afar, were cracked and crumbling when seen up close. Inside was a maze of narrow, crooked alleys. The buildings pressed close, their facades blank, chalky, windowless. Everything was white, as if the people who lived here had known nothing of colour. They rode past heaps of sun-washed rubble where houses had fallen in, and elsewhere saw the faded scars of fire. At a place where six alleys came together, Danny passed an empty marble plinth. Dothraki had visited this place before, it would seem. Perhaps even now, the missing statue stood among the other stolen gods in Vase Dothrak. She might have ridden past it 100 times, never knowing. On her shoulder, Viserion hissed. They made camp before the remnants of a gutted palace, on a windswept plaza where devil grass grew between the paving stones. Danny sent out men to search the ruins. Some went reluctantly, yet they went. And one scarred old man returned a brief time later, hopping and grinning, his hands overflowing with figs. They were small, withered things, yet her people grabbed for them greedily, jostling and pushing at each other, stuffing the fruit into their cheeks and chewing blissfully. Other searchers returned with tales of other fruit trees, hidden behind closed doors in secret gardens. Aego showed her a courtyard overgrown with twisting vines and tiny green grapes, and Jogo discovered a well where the water was pure and cold. Yet they found bones, too, the skulls of the unburied dead, bleached and broken.
"Ghosts," Iri muttered. "Terrible ghosts. We must not stay here, Khaleesi. This is their place."
"I fear no ghosts. Dragons are more powerful than ghosts. And figs are more important. Go, Wishikwe, and find me some clean sand for a bath, and trouble me no more with silly talk." In the coolness of her tent, Danny blackened horse meat over a brazier and reflected on her choices. There was food and water here to sustain them, and enough grass for the horses to regain their strength. How pleasant it would be to wake every morning in the same place, to linger among shady gardens, eat figs, and drink cool water, as much as she might desire. When Iri and Jiquy returned with pots of white sand, Danny stripped and let them scrub her clean.
"Your hair is coming back, Khaleesi," Jiquy said, as she scraped sand off her back.
Danny ran a hand over the top of her head feeling the new growth. Dothraki men wore their hair in long oiled braids, and cut them only when defeated. Perhaps I should do the same, she thought, to remind them that Drogo's strength lives within me now. Khal Drogo had died with his hair uncut, a boast few men could make. Across the tent, Rhaegal unfolded green wings to flap and flutter a half foot before thumping to the carpet. When he landed, his tail lashed back and forth in fury, and he raised his head and screamed. If I had wings, I would want to fly too, Danny thought. The Targaryens of old had ridden upon dragonback when they went to war. She tried to imagine what it would feel like to straddle a dragon's neck and soar high into the air. It would be like standing on a mountaintop, only better. The whole world would be spread out below. If I flew high enough, I could even see the Seven Kingdoms and reach up and touch the comet. Iria broke her reverie to tell her that Sir Jorah Mormont was outside awaiting her pleasure. "Send him in," Danny commanded, sand-scrubbed skin tingling. She wrapped herself in the lion skin. The Hakaa had been much bigger than Danny, so the pelt covered everything that wanted covering.
"I've brought you a peach," Sir Jorah said, kneeling.
It was so small she could almost hide it in her palm, and overripe, too. But when she took the first bite, the flesh was so sweet she almost cried. She ate it slowly, savouring every mouthful, while Sir Jorah told her of the tree it had been plucked from in a garden near the western wall. "Fruit and water and shade," Danny said, her cheeks sticky with peach juice. "The guards were good to bring us to this place."
"We should rest here until we're stronger," the knight urged. "The Redlands are not kind to the weak."
"My handmaids say there are ghosts here."
"There are ghosts everywhere," Sir Jorah said softly. "We carry them with us, wherever we go."
Yes, she thought. Viserys, Khal Drogo, my son Rhaego, they are with me always. "Tell me the name of your ghost, Jorah. You know all of mine." His face grew very still.
"Her name was Lyness."
"Your wife?"
"My second wife."
It pains him to speak of her, Danny saw, but she wanted to know the truth. "Is that all you would say of her?" The lion's pelt slid off one shoulder, and she tugged it back into place. "Was she beautiful?"
"Very beautiful."
Sir Jorah lifted his eyes from her shoulder to her face.
"The first time I beheld her, I thought she was a goddess come to earth, the maid herself made flesh. Her birth was far above my own. She was the youngest daughter of Lord Leighton Hightower of Oldtown. The White Bull, who commanded your father's King's Guard, was her great uncle. The Hightowers are an ancient family, very rich and very proud."
"And loyal," Danny said. "I remember Viserys said the Hightowers were among those who stayed true to my father."
"That's so," he admitted.
"Did your fathers make the match?"
"No," he said. "Our marriage..." "That makes a long tale, and a dull one, Your Grace. I would not trouble you with it."
"I have nowhere to go," she said. "Please."
"As my queen commands," Sir Jorah frowned. "My home, you must understand that to understand the rest. Bear Island is beautiful, but remote. Imagine old gnarled oaks and tall pines, flowering thorn bushes, grey stones bearded with moss, little creeks running icy down steep hillsides. The Hall of the Mormonts is built of huge logs and surrounded by an earthen palisade. Aside from a few crofters, my people live among the coasts and fish the seas. The island lies far to the north. Now winters are more terrible than you can imagine, Khaleesi. Still, the island suited me well enough, and I never lacked for women. I had my share of fishwives and crofters' daughters before and after I was wed. I married young, to a bride of my father's choosing, a glover of deep wood mutt. 10 years we were wed, or near enough, as makes no matter. She was a plain-faced woman, but not unkind. I suppose I came to love her, after a fashion, though our relations were dutiful rather than passionate. 3 times she miscarried while trying to give me an heir. The last time she never recovered. She died not long after.
Danny put her hand on his and gave his fingers a squeeze. I'm sorry for you, truly. Sir Jorah nodded.
By then my father had taken the black, so I was lord of Bear Island in my own right. I had no lack of marriage offers, but before I could reach a decision, Lord Balon Greyjoy rose in rebellion against the usurper, and Ned Stark called his banners to help his friend Robert. The final battle was on Pike, when Robert's stone-throwers opened a breach in King Balon's wall. A priest from Myr was the first man through, but I was not far behind, and for that I won my knighthood. To celebrate his victory, Robert ordained that a tourney should be held outside Lannisport. It was there I saw Lyness, a maid half my age. She had come up from Old Town with her father to see her brother's joust. I could not take my eyes off her. In a fit of madness, I begged her favour to wear in the tourney, never dreaming she would grant my request. Yet she did. I fight as well as any man, Khaleesi, but I have never been a tourney knight. Yet with Lyness's favour knotted round my arm, I was a different man. I won joust after joust. Lord Jason Mallister fell before me, and Bronzion Royce, Sir Ryman Frey, his brother, Sir Hostine, Lord Wint, Strongbore, even Sir Boris Blunt of the King's Guard. I unhorsed them all. In the last match, I broke 9 lances against Jaime Lannister to no result, and King Robert gave me the champion's laurel. I crowned Lyness Queen of Love and Beauty, and that very night went to her father and asked for her hand. I was drunk as much on glory as on wine. By rights, I should have gotten a contemptuous refusal, but Lord Leighton accepted my offer. We were married there in Lannisport, and for a fortnight I was the happiest man in the wide world.
Only a fortnight? Asked Danny. Even I was given more happiness than that with Drogo, who was my sun and stars.
A fortnight was how long it took us to sail from Lannisport back to Bear Island. My home was a great disappointment to Lyness. It was too cold, too damp, too far away. My castle no more than a wooden long-haul. We had no masks, no mummer shows, no balls or fairs. Seasons might pass without a singer ever coming to play for us. There's no goldsmith on the island. Even meals became a trial. My cook knew little beyond his roast and stews, and Lyness soon lost her taste for fish and venison. I lived for her smiles. And so I sent all the way to Old Town for a new cook, and brought a harper from Lannisport. Goldsmiths, jewellers, dressmakers, whatever she wanted, I found for her. But it was never enough. Bear Island is rich in bears and trees, and poor in aught else. I built a fine ship for her, and we sailed to Lannisport, an Old Town, for festivals and fairs, and once even to Braavos, where I borrowed heavily from the moneylenders. It was as a tourney champion that I had won her heart and hand, so I entered other tourneys for her sake. But the magic was gone. I never distinguish myself again. And each defeat meant the loss of another charger and another suit of jousting armor, which must needs be ransomed or replaced. The cost could not be borne. Finally, I insisted we return home. But there matters grew even worse than before. I could no longer pay the cook and the harper, and Lyness grew wild when I spoke of pawning her jewels. The rest, I did things it shames me to speak of, for gold, so Lyness might keep her jewels, her harper, and her cook. In the end, it cost me all. When I heard that Eddard Stark was coming to Bear Island, I was so lost to honor that rather than stay and face his judgment, I took her with me into exile. Nothing mattered but our love, I told myself. We fled to Lys, where I sold my ship for gold to keep us.
His voice was thick with grief, and Danny was reluctant to press him any further. Yet she had to know how it ended. Did she die there? She asked him gently.
Only to me, he said. In half a year my gold was gone, and I was obliged to take service as a sellsword. While I was fighting Bravossi on the Roin, Lyness moved into the manse of a merchant prince named Tregar or Mullen. They say she is his chief concubine now, and even his wife goes in fear of her.
Danny was horrified. Do you hate her?
Almost as much as I love her, Ser Jorah answered. Pray excuse me, my queen. I am very tired.
She gave him leave to go. But as he was lifting the flap of her tent, she could not stop herself calling after him with one last question.
What did she look like, your Lady Lyness?
Ser Jorah smiled sadly. Why, she looked a bit like you, Daenerys. He bowed low. Sleep well, my queen.
Danny shivered and pulled the lion-skin tight about her.
She looked like me.
It explained much that she had not truly understood.
He wants me, she realized. He loves me as he loved her, not as a knight loves his queen, but as a man loves a woman.
She tried to imagine herself in Ser Jorah's arms, kissing him, pleasuring him, letting him enter her. It was no good. When she closed her eyes, his face kept changing into Drogo's. Khal Drogo had been her sun and stars, her first, and perhaps he must be her last. The Meiji Mira Mazdur had sworn she would never bear a living child. And what man would want a barren wife? And what man could hope to rival Drogo, who had died with his hair uncut, and rode now through the nightlands, the stars his Khalasar? She had heard the longing in Ser Jorah's voice when he spoke of his Bear Island. He can never have me, but one day I can give him back his home and honor. That much I can do for him. No ghosts troubled her sleep that night. She dreamed of Drogo and the first ride they had taken together on the night they were wed. In the dream it was not horses they rode, but dragons. The next morn she summoned her blood riders. Blood of my blood, she told the three of them, I have need of you. Each of you is to choose three horses, the hardiest and healthiest that remain to us. Load as much water and food as your mounts can bear, and ride forth for me. Ego shall strike southwest, Rakaro due south. Jogo, you are to follow Shirakia on southeast. What shall we seek, Khaleesi? Asked Jogo. Whatever there is, Danny answered. Seek for other cities, living and dead. Seek for caravans and people. Seek for rivers and lakes and the great salt sea. Find how far this waste extends before us and what lies on the other side. When I leave this place, I do not mean to strike out blind again. I will know where I am bound and how best to get there.